Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Kate Loving Schenck, and Joan Adams and I host this show. Our guests this evening are astrology's astrologer, Sheila Adette, and Joanne Glass. We will be discussing mothers and daughters and how we can best make real those relationships and heal them. Last week, on October the 13th, Sheila's mother passed on, and this was on my own mother's birthday, and the same day of the triumphant Chilean miner rescue. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Joan Adams. Good evening, dear Joan.
What fun. This is going to be wonderful.
Well, that was an interesting sound.
What was that? I don't know.
Okay. It might have been something... telling me to bring on Sheila and Joanne. Hello there.
Hi.
How
are you?
Hi. Say hi, Joanne. I said hi. I said hi already. I broke in already. I shouldn't have.
Why not?
Well,
hi, Joan.
Hi, Sheila. Hi, Joanne.
Yes, good to
How are you, Joan?
Wonderful. Thank you. And you?
I'm good. I'm good.
Good.
She's a lot better than she was, I say, about 3 hours ago or even a week ago, okay?
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Well, I know.
This losing the
mother thing is very heavy stuff.
It is heavy stuff.
Well, you know.
And I am sorry about that, Joanne.
It's Sheila's mom died. Mine died many years
Sheila's
ago.
Sheila's mom died. Okay.
Yeah. Mine. She was 88. And, you know, it was congestive heart failure. And my mom was a dancer. And, professional dancer, teacher, and they told me in the ICU to come because, you know, that she had congestive heart failure, which me, in my ultimate wisdom of not knowing anything, thought that that would be peaceful. Well, no, it was not peaceful, and I got the full thing of Dylan Thomas's poem, Rage, Rage Against the Dying of the Light, because her legs were kicking and she had five people around her to hold her down and spit the medicine at the man. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And I said, are you sure that she has congestive heart failure, you know? So they said yes. And... So they had her in one of these chairs that you sit up, I guess, when that's happening, right, Kate?
Jerry chairs.
It's like a Jerry chair. Yeah. So that they didn't want to lay her down, and so I said, give her more medicine. And the nurse looked at me and said, I can't do that. We've already given her some. I said, she spit it out, and I said, I don't think there's any fear that she's going to become an addict, you know, at 88. And
right.
I mean,
and not to mention on her deathbed.
Yeah, well, yeah. The rules are phenomenally stupid, you know.
Right.
So anyway, she didn't die that night, and the next day, one of my son was with me, one of my sons, but my other son was out of town, and so finally, we got the other son on the phone, and I said, you know, he couldn't get here in time, and I said, I'll put the phone to her ear, and so up until that time, she was really, like, fighting still, and he said, I love you, Grandma, and she nodded her head, and John, my other son, said, she's breathing better now, and she died.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
She died.
It was a miracle.
Yeah.
I mean, she had to hear his voice in order to go, and I really was, on the way out, my son, we were driving in the car, and I said, I spoke to my dad out loud and said, are you around? And the radio turned on, and it was like, by way. John said, you did that. I said, I did not touch the radio. And he did not touch the radio. And this radio is a really quirky radio. Sometimes, you know, it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, but this was basically, you know, this was the first time I'd ever been around anyone who passed over. I wasn't there. My father, he passed before I got there. So I was not. Joanne, you were, right?
Oh, yeah, I was with my mother, yes.
She was with?
My mother, yeah. I've been with several people when they died.
Were you with yours, Kitty? I mean, Kate?
Yes.
Yes, she was. Yeah, it was a big one.
That's quite the story. Once again, it's the congestive heart failure deal. And but anyway, it was one of those things where it was Delaney, Tom, and I, and we were with her and noticing that she started looking, she had aged in her illness, which was first of all a stroke and then a heart attack and then just this congestive heart failure, which makes it difficult to breathe. And I think people fight against that. It's you know that your breath is failing you, which is something that hasn't happened in your whole life.
Right.
And it becomes people panic. And she wasn't panicking, though, but you could tell it was very difficult for her. And she did get some medicine to help with that. But anyway, she had aged over this period of time.
Right.
And she looked had a lot more lines in her face and so forth when she was in her illness that she ever had, even though she was 73. That's not very old.
No.
And all of a sudden, as she was dying, all of the lines disappeared on her face.
Wow.
And she appeared as a 14-year-old child. And the spirit, as it was leaving her body, kind of lit up the room.
Mm-hmm.
And we all saw it. And for 3 or 4 days after that, I experienced this incredible feeling of unconditional love where I did not have any animosity or ill will or any people I thought of that would have normally sent me into some sort of anger state. I had a total feeling of love for everything and everybody, and it lasted for about 3 days. Now, of course, there was this grief that came in and so forth, but it came and it went, and there was this feeling of total ecstasy, of being blessed by by enlightenment. And
well, and you know,
go ahead.
You know, well, when Kitty Loving Chang died, it was the harmonic conversion.
That was when it happened.
It was that monumental weekend of the harmonic conversion, and my friend Bill went over to the church. And said, he said, I have the feeling that the ashes are still here and that your father didn't want to take them right away. He was just too upset, remember?
Yeah.
He was very, very upset, and he just couldn't deal with that. And my friend Bill said, I have the feeling that she's still over there. So I went over to the office and I said, are Kitty's ashes still here? And the woman said, yes, they're here behind the typewriter. I said, what did you just say to me? She said, I said, you're telling me that Kitty Loving is behind the typewriter? I said, please, Kate, I said, please give her to me right away. And the woman was glad to give her to me, okay?
Yeah.
So, come to think of it, she didn't ask me if I was family or anything.
No, she knew you. That was your, yeah. She knew us. She knew you were okay.
So I brought them out on the deck, and I sat with them. I sat
yeah,
with
Harmonic Convergence. We commune.
Yeah,
with
I
Kitty.
Sat and talked to Kitty that
yep.
whole weekend.
Yep.
And, you know, Kitty's ashes. I talked to her.
Yeah.
And but the one of the other wonderful stories was that, you know, Kitty Loving Shank was a Catholic but didn't want to be a Catholic. Is that the way I explain
yeah.
it, Kate?
Well,
so one,
sure.
One time I was
yeah.
doing a lecture, and I was, what did I say, Joanna? I said Catholic.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, the Unitarian that Kitty was, she stood up. What did you say, Joanne?
She said,
you
Roman
Catholic.
Catholic
with a small
Roman
feet.
Catholic.
Yes,
Roman
yeah,
Catholic.
She
Roman
said,
Catholic.
I said, thank you, Kitty Loving. And she said, you're welcome. And she was honest to God, Joan, you've never, this woman was something, okay?
Obviously.
So when she was dying, I called Frank and her husband and said, do you mind if I take some medicine? And he said, no, I didn't call him. I took them in, but I hid them. I hid them. That's what
you called him about the last rites.
No,
yeah.
I hid the medals up above the bed so no one could see them and no one would get upset. And of course, she wanted to say, when she was dying, remember this, she wanted to say the Catholic prayer. And
I don't think Kate was there that day. It was
okay.
Delaney and you and I.
And Delaney and Joanne
yeah.
looked at each other, and I stepped in and said, you know, I
she
did.
She said, yeah, she went right into the whole Catholic.
Yeah, the whole Catholic last thing, and so I knew it. So
mm-hmm.
I felt,
mm-hmm.
you know, very, but she did revert back to Catholicism.
Yeah.
In
the last
remember
yeah,
in those moments. And I... So they said they were going to take her to another room, and this dear nurse was there, and I said, listen, do you mind, I whispered, taking these medals with her? And the nurse said, this is in a Catholic hospital, by the way, do you mind taking these? And I said, but they can't be seen. So please hide them when you get to the other room. And the nurse looked at me and said, it's done. And so when I walked into the other room, there was a great big silver pin right on top of her breast with all the medals hanging there.
No, for God's sake.
Yeah. She didn't hide them at all. It was very, very funny, you know?
Yeah, yes.
So,
what was your experience hanging out with the ashes for 3 days?
Like you just said, it was all completely light, and I thought, I don't think that, you know, anyone could pass on a more high holy moment.
No.
Because
no.
everybody on the planet, the entire planet was praying. And you could
right.
feel that high holy energy. And I thought anybody that goes out in this high holy energy must be, you know, one of the high chiefs. I mean, you know, just one of the high chiefs. So when my mom died on her birthday, I pulled Kitty's astrological chart out, which I, you know, I studied. I mean, I worked with her with astrology all the time. I would go to New York, and then I would go to class, and then I would come back, and Kitty and I would go over all of the notes, you know,
mm-hmm.
from that I would bring home from class. And so she has this Uranus Jupiter in Aquarius, which in my mom's chart is right on the passage out.
Mm.
So it's almost like a Kitty Loving Shank is a guide,
mm-hmm.
is some
mm-hmm.
kind of a midwife
yeah.
on the other side. That's the feeling I got. And my mother's progressed moon was in Aquarius, also right on top of this aspect in Kitty's chart, and also this aspect in my father's chart, because he had the moon in Aquarius.
Mm.
So there was certainly I felt that that she was being welcomed in a major kind of way, you know,
mm.
to
mm-hmm.
the other side. So It was what, Joanne?
Well, and the Chilean minor thing going on there, high energy, vast energy on that. I thought it was remarkable event. It was like the moon landing.
Oh, it was.
First, it truly was, and even having the astronauts, the NASA experts, helping them cope with this, how to handle this event, and when I don't know, I thought it was incredible. And they have Kitty and Sheila's mother, and then another friend who was who would have been 100 in December. She would have been 100. She died at 8 o'clock that morning, and and the whole. What's interesting is that relationship with mothers. Now you describe your relationship with your mother, Kate. I don't know what yours was like with yours, Joan. But
thinking.
How was it?
Oh, wonderful! I was thinking. My mom loved to laugh and she loved to whistle. But I was thinking, as you were talking, Sheila, about your mom. My mom had Alzheimer's from the age of 57.
Yeah.
So we really didn't have her as a senior at all. But when she was, I remember at one point she was in the nursing home and it was a nightmare. Or maybe Daddy still had her home. But at one point, anyway, you couldn't keep her from being agitated, you know.
No, I know.
And Daddy said, well, give her some more of whatever it is, Librium, I think it was. And they said, no, she'll get addicted.
Oh, God.
And my sweet father says, addicted, hell.
He gave her
whatever it takes at this point.
Yeah.
For goodness
sake,
she didn't know she was on the earth, you know.
What difference
does that make? So I did think about that with your story. It's like, let's use some common sense here.
You know, the medicine is made for something.
Yeah.
I mean, looking at it, you know, the medicine was not put in here on earth for nothing. It was here for certain kinds of things. It's like when I had my knee operation, and I said, oh, no, I won't take that. And the doctor said, what do you feel like when you take that? I said, I feel like my head goes to mush. He said, I don't think we have any fear of you getting addicted.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, it's for people that like it, Sheila. You know?
Yeah.
So
I mean, if somebody with Alzheimer's got addicted.
Yes,
I mean,
well, you'd probably be happy about it. I'm sorry.
If it works, hey, whatever works. But
I think that there are definitely reasons to worry about addiction, but not when somebody's on their deathbed, for heaven's sake, or any other different. There's many different scenarios where you just don't worry about that.
No, it's like I had a friend in the 90s, and she went to the doctor one day, and she said the doctor told her, Frances, you don't have to worry about your cholesterol anymore.
Yeah.
Eat what you want to and enjoy your life, you know. I mean, it's about common sense.
Yeah.
It is.
It really is.
Well, what fascinates me, too, about that, you've mentioned on this that your mother, Joan, had Alzheimer's. Sheila's mother had, there was a...
It was Alzheimer's.
It was or dementia or something. But there was more than that. Kitty, you had a loving relationship with your mom, but there were also moments of estrangement, were there not, Kate?
What would you say?
A disagreement, or how would you put it?
I'm sorry, something just dropped in my foot when you said that. That's very interesting.
Yeah,
you might say that there was a lot of estrangement because the thing about Kitty was. Well, and another thing you have to understand, too, in my generation.
Yeah.
Well, our generation, whatever. There was a lot of rebellion. There's nothing like our generation. And I was just talking about that with my brother this last week when I was down. There's just an amazing difference where nothing has ever been like this before or since where, you know, you had life as we know it up until a certain point, and then there was a total revolution in every way.
Woodstock, yeah.
And the civil rights movement and everything else. And my parents were very involved in the civil rights movement, but there was something about the kids then getting involved with, the revolution in terms of just dropping out and just going haywire that even they, my parents, as liberal as they were, they could not really stand that.
Yeah, right.
Now, another thing about my mom is that she was a very strong-willed person. She wanted to control her children. She wanted to know everything about where we were, what we were doing, and she wanted to be a part of it, and she had huge abandonment issues because really, in truth, her parents both abandoned her, and she was raised by the Roman Catholic nuns from 3 to 13. So she had huge abandonment issues, and it took everything personally.
Yeah.
So we had problems with all of that, and there's a lot of stuff going on. Then I would see her out in public, and I would see her with other people, and she was just a spiritual giant.
Yeah.
And she stood, and she always stood up and said exactly what she thought, and people either loved her or hated her. And I came to really respect her, but I didn't really think she necessarily, as far as she being my mom and me being her daughter, there was a lot of stuff. And I actually ran away from home and disappeared, and I'm sure I've caused her terrible angst. And I don't feel guilty about it, though, because I used to. The reason I used to is because I didn't put it into the context of the whole 60s thing. It really wasn't my fault, you know. I was swept along by the times, as it were. So, and so later on, we came back together, and I think that after a while, she grew to trust me, and I mean, I was always difficult when it came to her, and but
you were strong-willed and pointed in your opinion as she was, but you ended up there together in a really holy, sacred moment. Did you not?
I think she actually there was tremendous healing at that time of death. At the time of death, but I mean, I think there was tremendous healing anyway.
Yeah,
but
extremely. I find that a lot of times, like my father could never. You know, he would never, ever brag about me, and then he would brag about to other people who would tell me what he said. And that's the way Kitty was with you. She would brag about you to me all the time, that you were you were into medicine and you were into studying all the time, and she was so proud of you, and you were going to be great in the medical field. See, she said that to me all the time. I had no idea that she didn't say it to you.
Oh, no. She was like, one time she told me that, I'll never forget it. It was like after I'd become a nurse and everything, she actually told me that medicine was blasphemy as far as, being something that was really healing, you know. Actually, she thought I would go into the medical profession and blend the alternative healing modalities with the tradition,
Well, that's what you do. That's what you do.
Actually true. Yeah, I haven't been able to extricate myself from that at all. But anyway, I cannot believe that she actually would brag about me at all. I mean, it's like I thought she hated me.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a gift of this conversation here. I mean, I don't think that we ever had we were working together with astrology and almost for a long time there for months, you know. And when I would come in from New York and on, and she would always tell me how proud she was of you. I think more so than any of the other ones. You were studying and you were going to be great in the medical field. I mean, come on. I mean, interesting.
That's great. So, now, are you going to say what you were going to say at your mother's funeral tomorrow?
Well, you know, we have
lunch. Let's bring this to a point.
We have lunch with this wonderful psychologist in Lancaster. Her name is Betty Finney, who started the HIV here. She was the first. She's 84. She was the first woman who ever pioneered in HIV and went into the hospital rooms and got a center. She's just, you know, phenomenal woman. Anyway, we have lunch a lot together, and she said to Joanne, and she looked at me, she said, well, are you going to speak at my mother's funeral tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I said yes, and she said, well, what are you going to say? And I said, first I'm going to say that... Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
That my mother was, you know, first a daughter, and I mean, basically... My mother was born, she weighed like 2 pounds, and it was at home, Kate. And they put her behind They put her in a cigar box behind the hot stove, one of those.
An incubator.
Like an incubator.
Uh-huh.
They didn't think she was going to live.
Right.
And so that's, she's outlived all of them, outlived all of them. Anyway, I said first she was, a daughter, and then she was, a wife, and then she was a mother, and then she was a dance teacher who basically took me, put ballet shoes on my feet when I was two, because she wanted to be a dancer. And then by the time I was nine, I was going every week to New York to study dance with her, but then I sprained my ankle, so she started taking my classes. So she didn't really become a professional dancer until she was 29, which is unheard of. And
yeah.
I walked into Carnegie Hall one day when I was late. The teacher, Madame Nechitova, was late getting there, and I heard this voice from the main studio, which was in front of Carnegie Hall, and it had, there were about 45 people in the beginner class of professional ballet, and I heard my mom's voice, and I went to the desk in the foyer, and I said to Miss Lee, "Is that my mom's voice?" She said, "She's in there teaching class." For
my mom
to be teaching class in Carnegie Hall, I just about fainted.
Oh,
I mean,
that's so wonderful.
That was such an achievement. So she became a teacher, a dance teacher, and then she brought New York to Lancaster. She literally started Dance Art Studio, and we traveled to, I don't know if anybody remembers the Steel Pier, but we did shows on the Steel Pier in Atlantic City. We entertained at all the veterans' hospitals. We did these huge professional recitals. They were very professional with professional lighting, and my father did the scene. I said, she became that. And then I said, and then she became my enemy. And Betty Finney, my friend, just about fell off the stool. And she looked at Joanne and said, "Do not let her talk. Do not let her get up in that pulpit."
What do you mean she was an enemy?
And she said, "You can't say that, Sheila." I said, "Well, it was the truth.
It was the truth.
It was the truth. We went to war over my children. Literally, she wanted my children. I mean, I went back to work, and I was in the studio and doing five shows at once and everything. And my mother literally wanted to pretend that they weren't my children when she cared for them, So she really.
You think maybe her mind was slipping?
No.
It's going to be slipping. I mean,
it was perfect control issue, huh?
It was literally that she wanted, I guess, a boy somewhere, okay, and that she had me who got her into dancing, and then, when I had a boy, she decided that was her boy,
mm-hmm.
and that
mm-hmm.
was the one, that last one that I just said before that said, "I love you, Grandma," and she died.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that was him,
And I said to Betty, I don't know why I can't say that, because why is it that, because of a church and because of religion and because of a pulpit, you can't tell the truth.
Well, let me just say that you're that you're not saying it with any kind of animosity.
No. It's a simple truth.
Yeah.
Which I think Sheila's come somewhat peacefully to terms with it.
Which means basically it's also somebody that you hit a wall with becomes a very defining teacher, because
that's
it makes
right.
you stronger. It makes you so
that's
much
right.
stronger.
And
like you're saying, Kate, just in a different kind of way with Kitty. So it's very interesting. And I think that my soul needed whatever it was that was happened there. My soul needed that also.
Mm-hmm.
So I heard you giggling, Joan.
I just think you're delightful.
Well, I decided maybe I wouldn't do that. So today I just wanted to read this over the air because it really is something.
This sums up.
"Dear Sheila, it has been many years since our paths crossed, but today when I read your mother's obituary in the Lancaster New Era, many things came up for me. My daughters took dance lessons from Miriam Menser. Maybe you remember them, Stephanie Quay and Nancy Quay. Each week the girls would eagerly run up the long flight of steps to learn from the beautiful Miriam Menser." See? The building was torn down.
Wait.
Huh? The building was torn down to make way for McDonald's, but for the thousands of young people who learned to love to dance, the memory will remain. Because of this training from your mother, my daughter danced all through high school in musicals and talent shows and into college dance also. My sympathy to you and your sons. May your sorrow be replaced with a peaceful feeling knowing your mother made a difference in so many thousand lives.
Wow.
Dearly Bernice Quay.
That's beautiful.
That's beautiful.
But not only that, I went on and started Lancaster Institute of Fine Arts. And,
yes.
And you know, had I not been put on the train at 9 and had shows on me at 2, I would not have indeed brought dance to a lot of people, also in theater. And so, I mean, this little woman that was born in a cigar box, you know, and survived all that and survived her sister dying when her tonsils were taken out and her brother dying of leukemia and all these deaths around her. She literally was psychic and said, I have to come home from camp at 14, and stopped at this accident and saw her mother's body on the road.
Oh.
And did not accept that and went home and locked herself in her room.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that, you know, that whole thing. But, you know, Kate, when I'm listening to you, I am thinking, basically, there's so many sides to a person.
Yeah.
There are so many things, so many sides and so many facets and so many, that it's really amazing that all of those personalities within a person. Amazing.
It is amazing.
Well, one of the things I think is important to add to this is that Sheila has not really laid eyes on her mother physically for it's been about 2 years, and that is due to the fact that whenever she would go there, Miriam would just do one of her things, and at Sheila just looked at her and said, "I am through with this. I am not going to be here anymore to be abused."
Well, Joan, it wasn't agitated. It was rage.
It was rage. No, it was...
Yeah.
And I went up to the front and I said, you know, I really shouldn't come because they can't settle her down.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it would be better if, you know, I didn't...
And now we have other people who look at this. And, for example, Sheila was in a group some years ago, a process group, in which everybody there were coming to terms and healing and connection with their parents, and had a hard time understanding why Sheila was just looking at hers and saying, go away and leave me alone, you know, I don't...
No, I did.
Yeah.
What I did in the middle of this huge process, I want to tell you that all these people, it was a 14-day process in Philadelphia, and all these people were yelling and screaming about, I mean, unbelievable work. But at the end and the last thing, you had to go to the middle of the room and say, what do you want your parents to do? I said, I want my mother to walk out that door, and I want my father to walk out that door.
Uh-huh.
And everybody in the group went, how could you say that?
They had a hard time accepting the truth of that feeling.
And I said,
yeah,
this is my process.
Yeah.
I paid to be here. That's what I would prefer, because the yelling and the screaming and all of the stuff that, you know, that you're in the middle of as a child and all. You know, this woman, and, you know, another woman just called me and said, oh, this is Shirley Shim from your childhood, and we always came to your parents' house, and they were such joy. And I'm going, whoa, you know, because they were. It was a neighborhood hangout until everybody left.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was a rage scene. Also.
Yeah, so...
See, that's the reason I'm interested in this is because you just never know, you know, because I know how much I've watched Sheila work with this in the face of other people's judgments, you know, people who go to see that's not her shtick. She has herself become more forgiving and accepting of who she is in her own strength patterns, which her mother had, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the releasing of that feeling of guilt and has just been so difficult for her, and here she stands now, and there's this huge vacuum because both her parents are now gone, and I tell you, her face is changing. I've tried to tell her this because I've seen her, and I know how much she was tied in to her mother's well-being, because even though her body was not there to look at her, her spirit was there to be with her, because her face would her mannerisms, her face would look like her mother's. It was incredible to see. I didn't say it as often as I saw it because it upset her to say it, you know. But
yeah.
I tell you, her face is now becoming her own.
But the gift was that she did allow me to be there.
Yes, she was there. And it was important that you were there, and you were there when she died, and I think that was absolutely had to be.
You're talking about
did.
The rage too.
Yes,
the
rage.
That Whitey had an aunt that I was trying to help care for.
Yeah.
Who really came after me and her and his dad did the same thing. Just really came after me, and I was the one that was running around doing all the stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody told me at that point that they always come after the ones they love the most.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Joan.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Sheila loved her mother very deeply.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Joan, that was really comforting
true.
For you to say that to me. I mean, I would go out, I was getting her clothes, I was just running, and I went in and took a turn, she threw everything on the floor and just started screaming, oh, man. And I looked at her and said, this is the end of this.
Yeah.
I mean, and I remember, sometimes when you walk down a hall, they're like, you know, it was one relationship I walked away from it. And, you know, there's those moments in life when you walk away and it's almost slow motion to get down the out of the building and down the hall.
Right.
I don't know. I guess all of you have gone through those kind of things. But,
the thing is, it's at some level, and I have to believe this, so I go stark raving crazy.
Mm-hmm.
At some level, Whitey's Aunt Helen knew. She knew what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
She knew why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to believe that. I have to believe that. Because she really attacked my kids.
Whoa.
She tried to hit me one day, and my Kathy jumped in between us and said, don't you even try it. But she didn't, at that point, she didn't understand anything anyway.
Yeah.
You know, she
didn't.
I was the enemy for whatever reasons. I got selected.
Yeah.
And but I was doing the best I could. I did the best I could. Period.
And the other thing is maybe I took the rage too seriously in the illness. You know, maybe I took her too seriously.
Well, and I think though that you're right in that your being there stirred it up.
Yep.
And for what it's worth, I did hand Helen her house keys one day. And she lived in a town 60 miles from here.
Mm-hmm.
And she had raged at me and demanded that I come there and put her in a home.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to the doctor's office, and she said, this is my niece, and she's trying to put me in the home. You know?
Oh, I know that.
And anyway, it got into a whole turmoil and holler and scream and match or whatever in the doctor's office. And we got on the way home, and I just handed her a key. I said, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
You know, I can't do it, and I'm not coming back.
Well, I went through that with, and Joanne will tell you, I had the lawyers there and the power of attorney.
I helped set that up.
Sign over the power of attorney so that we could settle our affairs, and she was smiling at everybody, and they walked, and Joanne went out to bring the lawyer in, and she looked at me and she said, if you think for one minute I don't, you're out of your mind.
Right.
And
I
went, and then they walked in and she smiled, and I got up, and Joanne said, where are you going, Sheila? I said, out the door.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Yeah.
Right. You can't deal with that.
Like,
you can't reason with that.
It kind of reminds me of Mama Dearest or something. Woo!
Yeah. Oh, Helen, Helen used
that
same
quality.
Tone of voice with me, Sheila.
What?
That same, that hateful, that rage, it's just pure evil hatred. And what am I supposed to do with that? I don't know. You know, I cry and carry on, you know.
Yeah.
I had enough's enough.
Yeah,
I came
well,
home. She died alone.
You keep saying you have to be strong enough to deal with that rage flying at you, and I guess I don't know. I wasn't.
Well,
I think it's abusive. I don't think we have to do that. I think it's abusive to be in the presence of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize you're talking about your mom, but She wasn't herself.
Yeah, well,
and
even when she was herself.
No, I think she was herself, Joan.
Oh, was she?
You, I think she was.
even, you know, I went
no,
with that rage.
I saw the woman in full flight. No, no.
That
no.
rage all my life, actually. Other people
okay,
didn't
now,
see it.
Now, what was she so enraged about?
I think she was enraged because she lost her father at 2. She lost her mother at 14. She didn't. I remember OCD where she washed her hands over and over and her clothes over and over. But fortunately, when she started the dance, she
it was a release.
Cured that disease in some way because she could then count tap steps.
Ah.
And she didn't have to wash her hands anymore.
Ah, okay.
She started, and the whole way home on the train or wherever we were, she would be counting out steps all the time. At the time, I thought she was really passionate about dance. But as I get further away from it, I see it was just another placement of the OCD.
Yes.
But she taught students like that, too. She had kids on the Steel Pier that were only 5 and 6 years old that looked like the Rockettes in New York. Because she wasn't mean to them, but it was tenacious. It was tenacious to get it right. And, you know, watching her teach, she was a good teacher, mind you, but I swore I was never going to teach like that. She would have a fit if I did not write down every step that I learned in New York. And see, that's when, you know, I told the story, I think, of the radio before, that this wonderful Japanese man that I took his class, there was a ritual sword dance, and you didn't get the sword for 6 months because it was the ritual. And I was in the class 3 weeks, and he handed me the sword. Now, I didn't know this damn dance. I mean, I was like, and it was, again, in the studio with 60 people watching me, all professional dancers. And I took the sword, and my mother was standing at the door. She literally fainted because I took the sword. And I knew the first 4 steps, Joan. So I did the first 4 steps, and I made up the whole rest of the dance. And at the end, there was complete silence, and then there was all the an ovation from everybody, including Nimura, the teacher. And he walked over, took the sword from me, and bowed to my mother with the sword and said, "You have a choreographer."
Oh,
now, that
cool.
man, I was 12. He saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
He somehow saw the gift of the choreographer in me. I don't know how, because I did. I always did it. You know, it was his steps and all I did in his class. But somehow he had some intuition about what was going on. And I never had to write another step down from that moment on. She changed my definition to choreographer. And everybody that would say anything, she would say, "I have a choreographer." So, you know, you never know when some of these people rename you, people name you, and free you in some way.
Yes, yes, that was quite a gift, a very intense moment of transformation.
Yeah.
Well, and see, looking at the larger perspective, you put that in perspective for you to for a reason. I mean, I Nimura was an intuitive. fascinating.
And the only card over all these years, his card is the only card that I have here in my space.
Mm-hmm.
The beautiful card. He was a teacher. I don't know. If Corkscrew, he could stand on one leg, put it like the yoga thing, put his other leg up like the tree, and he could corkscrew down to the floor and then come back up again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, phenomenal. He was like Martha Graham, only he was Japanese. But he was like Martha Graham, you know. And every time you do something of his, he would go, "That's wrong." Do it over. That's wrong. But he was a wonderful teacher. But Miriam was a count teacher. Do it on the beat. Count. Do it exactly like I do it. Do it. I was more of a, you know, I'll give you an idea, and then you give me what you got, and then we'll do it together.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a wonderful, I don't know if you knew Dennis Kimball, Kate, did you?
I heard him.
He was a wonderful actor from New York. He was into opera. He wrote operas, and he was in the National Company in summer stock here in the Fulton. And, you know, it's very funny, you know, because he really worked with me with that. I would give him a step, and he wouldn't do it. He would just look at me, and then I'd give him another one. He said, "I'll be back tomorrow." And then he'd put those steps together in his intricate way. And I used to howl. I used to go, "That's unique."
mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's so much better when you let the actor, you know, or the dancer come back with their interpretation. I guess
yes.
That's what's good in life, too.
Well, you know, I hate to say this, but I just can't get that image out of my mind of this poor little baby in a cigar box behind a stove, a hot stove, probably a wood stove in those days.
Yeah, it was a wood stove.
Had to keep it warm.
Well,
I guess
that's what they did, didn't they, Kate?
That's what they did. Yeah.
Well, you know, they did try to save those babies. So the fact that she was still, at least they didn't throw her out before. I don't know. She had to have a lot of trauma surrounding that event.
A lot of trauma.
Well, nobody knew that her mother was pregnant. And then the doctor delivered the baby on Christmas Eve. It was Christmas Eve.
Oh.
And
what was the due date?
I don't know. Oh, come on, Kate. get a grip. Sure, I will just go do-do-do-do-do, right? It was, you know...
It was Christmas Eve,
and then the next day, my grandmother was... Her mother was really something, obviously. And the doctor came in, and she said, I would like to go down and get to see the Christmas tree. And he said, Mary, you've been down to see the Christmas tree. Don't tell me. You just came up and jumped in bed when I came. But, you know, Miriam... Miriam really, I mean, she lived, she survived, and, you know, she was telling me the poverty in the family was that her best present was this orange that her grandmother gave her. She could never wait that it was just this great, big, beautiful orange. So, you know, coming out of that kind of poverty and...
Let me ask a question about your sons. How did they experience your mother?
A whole different woman.
My mother cooked 3 meals a day, took care of them, a hand and foot. I would walk in after, you know, coming from the studio and rehearsal, and I would go, who is this woman? I don't know this woman. Because, see, what I did was my dad picked me up at school, and then we went out for dinner at a restaurant, and then I had to be in the studio to teach. And then I was in the studio. That was my life. This woman that was running around the kitchen like Betty Crocker, you know, I didn't know this woman. I mean, cooking turkeys and doing all this stuff. She looked at me. It was strange. And, you know, my sons who are taking it very hard, my one son particularly, I said, you know, and we sat together. I said, you know, I just didn't know the woman you knew.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Exactly.
I mean,
And I hate to say it now. In this climate that we live in so often, let's say here in Lancaster County, you see it all the time. The women just love the sons.
Oh, yeah.
And the girls are not that important.
Yes. Well, had she not had me, she would have never got into the dance world the way she did. I was her ticket in.
Absolutely.
I mean, I was the ticket in, and I understand that, and by being the ticket in, I really was very fortunate in many ways. But you know, it's the sons couldn't have done that.
No.
So, but you're right about the whole male thing, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's in all the cultures, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
I think it's time to claim. To actually see this for what it is, that women need to be strong in these relationships, and as I hope mothers treat. I think that the generations coming up do treat their daughters with as equal respect as they do their sons, and I don't think that's really an issue as it once was, and that the relationships between parents are often and children are often. Difficult, and that's the only way we can get into this dimension.
That's where you get your lesson.
Yeah,
it's the wall you push against.
Yeah,
and you know I've been working right along. Like next time, maybe I'll talk about it about the first lunar return that you have when moon comes around from 26 to 28, it's a transformation. But the second lunar return, when it comes around from between, you know, 58 and 60, is a transmutation. It's a different. I did a lot of work on that because I was doing charts from England. I was doing a mother-daughter chart. One was going, having the first lunar return, and the mother was having the second one. And so I was thinking, what is the difference? A transmutation is like, it's you don't need someone else to birth you, you know. It's you go down to the ashes of all you are, and you rise up out of that.
The phoenix.
It's like the phoenix rising. So it's a totally different kind of thing. And then again, you know, 30 years later, you have another one. So I don't know what that one is. I have to work on it.
Well, I've gone through three. Well, the thing is that the Chilean minor capsules were called the phoenix.
Yeah, I couldn't believe they were called the phoenix coming up. Yeah, they called
it. You know what was really interesting too? I want to hear about the 100-year-old or the 99-year-old funeral too. But what I thought was interesting is that 22 people brought up. It took 22 people to bring up the 33 minors.
Was it 22? I didn't know that. Numerology's been fascinating. Yeah.
Yes, it has.
Yeah.
And 33 were all important. The 33 number, when they busted through, it was a 33-day numerology. The numerology is unbelievable with the number 33.
Yeah.
Which is the healing service and Christ number. And, oh, man. Well, there's a woman, the funeral I did on Sunday afternoon for this, my friend, which was an old friend. And I knew her through a dream group and through esoteric circles. And
well,
Esther Lewis.
Okay.
You remember Esther Lewis? What?
Yes.
And she, I wrote out this thing, and I of course, I was tying in with, I did with the Chilean miners, and in fact, and I wrote this page and a half rough draft as to start with, and sent it to her, took it out to her daughter. And her daughter hyperventilated to the point where she had to breathe into a paper bag for 5 minutes to get calm after she read it.
Well, she called on the phone, and the phone was ringing, and the answering, and this woman was going, I need to talk to Joanne. And Joanne came in the house whistling, and I said, I think you better call that woman back. And Joanne said,
Well, she cut out everything but two paragraphs. All the esoteric stuff was completely eliminated, even including a listing of her brothers and sisters. She eliminated, and I looked. It was really interesting to me because Esther Lewis was a woman. She lived to be 90, you know, almost 100, and she was an avid reader. She was an esoteric philosopher. She upholstered. She quilted. You name it, she did it. And her daughter was born. She and Bill were married 11 years before the daughter was born. And the sun rose and set in this child. I mean, she was just the apple of their eye, no question about it. And obviously, Barbara looked at me and she said, "This is my. I mean, I want to be comforted, and I will not be comforted if you do that."
Well,
I didn't do that. I didn't do that.
Yeah.
But I typed out what I would have done and gave to the three or four others of us who were there, who knew this side of Esther, and told them, so they appreciated the thought. But it was Esther was a spiritual, she was a poet, and I just thought, I wrote Barbara back. I was glad she was happy with it, but I said, it seems that you're uncomfortable with your mother's esoteric spiritual beliefs, which were so so important to her, and I think part of the source of her creativity. But Barbara has not written me back in response to that one.
I wonder why.
She didn't want to hear that.
No, but bless her heart. I mean, honestly, lovely.
Yeah.
She was a school counselor. Her profession was school counseling. So it's interesting, you know, our mothers and our filter. And I think about my own mother, I got into when I became a Unitarian. She started praying for my soul because she was sure I was a heathen and going to hell. And I had trouble with my healing. I mean, I looked at her to put hands on for healing, and she said, "Is it safe for you to do that?"
Well, and I asked the funeral director on the phone tonight. Joanne said, "I cannot wear robes to do the eulogy because we're doing this in a Catholic church." And so I was very insistent. So I said to the funeral director, "You can't listen. You can't. Why can't Joanne wear robes?" Now, I've never heard this man laugh. He laughed till he cried. That's how hard he laughed.
How ridiculous it is.
That's how ridiculous that question was to him. He was just laughing and laughing. I said, well, I'm glad I made your day. But, you know, it's supposed to be, imagine religions that can cross lines. Imagine if all the, these, and the political lines now, these commercials, I don't know how you people feel about them, but these commercials about just ripping the other person apart, I think.
It's wrong.
It's appalling. And, you know, the one I had to laugh at was the McDonald's, though, when she came on and said, I'm not a witch. I'm just like you. I laughed for 15 minutes. I was looking at the television going, I don't care if you're a witch, you know? I mean, but it's so funny, your little face. I'm not a witch. I'm just like you. And who cares if she was a witch at 19? You know?
What would be great is to say, I am a witch and I'm just like you. I don't know.
That would be a better line, Kay. And it's Halloween, right?
It's Halloween.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, you know, just get on the TV and say what you can do. You don't have to put the other person down.
I know. I feel sorry for all of them. And I was involved in politics a little bit here and there, and I've handed in my keys, I'll tell you. Woo!
No, I did some time ago because it's all, it's interesting. Things are really changing rapidly. Anyway, turning to mothers, I mean, I think we choose our parents for the experience we have, the needs we have to go up against disciplines or whatever they give us to become the persons we're meant to be. We're sent into the world to be, to make our choices and become citizens of not only the world, but of the spirit.
You know,
yeah.
I always, always appreciated Liza Minnelli with Judy Garland. I have never heard one word out of her mouth about, the whole addiction thing and all of that stuff. She always said she was a wonderful mother. I mean, and all of them, Lorna Loft, the other ones, all of them. So it's
Kitty was like that with her mother. Her mother, I think, was, she abandoned her. She was an out and out alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
She was just, but my mother never, ever, ever said a bad word about her. She just adored her.
Her stories were wonderful about her mom.
Yeah.
The wonderful story about Kitty Loving Chank is when the nun, she said, she excused herself in class. You know that one? And she went out because the nun said you can call God on God anytime. So she went out into the hall and dialed the number on the phone and said, what's his number? I'm calling God. And the nun said, no, I didn't mean that. She said, she was so literal. Well, you said I could call God.
Yeah, yeah. And now you're taking it back?
You're taking it back, yeah.
Yeah, it's so funny. It was. Wasn't your mother a hairdresser?
Sheila,
grandmother,
I got to tell you one thing before we go. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Had a wonderful therapist for many years, female lady. And she always did say that unless we deal with our stuff, our emotional stuff,
mm-hmm.
growing up,
mm-hmm.
then we become hell on wheels in the nursing home.
and
she had a ball in the nursing home herself, let me tell you. She had a ball. But she had done her work.
Mm-hmm.
So the lesson for you and for me from all this rage and stuff and stuff
mm-hmm.
and stuff
uh-huh.
is to be sure we deal with our stuff before we get
right.
to that point.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so we don't do it to the people that we love.
Well, it's really
right?
interesting because when
True.
You're in the Alzheimer's wing, when you're in that wing, you see these people with Alzheimer's that are almost beatific. I mean, they're just
mm-hmm.
smiling. And this little man opened the door and he said, I've lost my wife. And my
Aww.
Son looked at him. He said, where is she? I know that she just left me off here and I can't find her. And so the nurse came and said, I think she's up around the corner. So the next day, we went in and she said, I've lost my friend, he said. I don't know where my friend is. He was just here a moment ago. And I said, I think you left him up around the corner. But the whole time, he had this beautiful smile on his face. You know, he wasn't
anxious or
yeah,
no.
Please.
And so, you know, they're then you see the rageful faces and the
mm-hmm.
sad faces, and then some of the faces are just look like angels.
Right.
So it's what you say, Joan, is,
true.
Very interesting.
Yeah. We've got to deal with our stuff.
Good. This has been good.
Yes.
Yeah. No.
Well, we
sure we don't carry
end.
It with us to the home.
What, dear?
Oh, I'm going to jump off a cliff before I go into a home. But anyway.
Yeah.
No, Kate, we're going to pass out poison cookies. We forgot to do the test, but we have an Alzheimer's test, my sisters and I.
Uh-huh.
And we did this test where you all sit around the table and you each get three beans.
Uh-huh.
And then you talk for 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of 5 minutes, if nobody's put a bean in their nose, nobody's got it yet. But
that's
if
funny.
Ever there's
that's
a bean
funny.
In the nose, the poison
bean
cookies
the
will
that's
be served.
That's hysterical, Dan.
Yeah.
That's funny. Wow.
Only you and your sisters, that's for sure.
For true.
Yes.
That's true.
What was the other one that I heard this week about? This man said that, you know, he said my brother is just absolutely crazy. He's absolutely nuts. He said he thinks everybody's a chicken. And the guy says, well, we'll have to straighten him out, and we'll have to take, you know, pretend that we take the chickens away. He said, what do you mean? Then we wouldn't have any eggs.
Who's on first?
Who's on first, right?
Oh, that's so
love
good.
It.
That's so good.
Good night. Good night.
Good
love
night.
You all.
Love y'all.
Good night.
Bye.
Music for mother and child. And you can buy the music on www.pray for healing. I think it's pray to heal. Pray2heal.com. Thank you.